Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Claude Hutchison, past president of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Directors and your chair for today's program. It's now my pleasure and honor to introduce today's special guest, Michelle Bachmann, U.S. Congresswoman from Minnesota and Republican candidate for the President of the United States. Michelle Bachmann says she's running for president to bring a new voice to the White House, a voice of constitutional conservatism, limited government, and a safe and secure America. Elected in 2006, Congresswoman Bachmann is the first Republican woman to be elected to the U.S. House of Representatives from the state of Minnesota. Prior to serving in Congress, she was elected to the Minnesota State Senate in 2000, where she championed the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights. Before that, she spent 5 years as a federal tax litigation attorney working on literally hundreds of civil and criminal cases. That experience solidified her strong support for efforts to simplify the tax code and the attendant complexities to reduce tax burdens on family and small business budgets. Representative Bachmann sits on the Financial Services Committee and the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. In July 2010, she hosted the first Tea Party caucus meeting. She is seen as a champion of the Tea Party and its values, including the call for lower taxes, renewed focus on the Constitution, and the need to shrink the size of government. Representative Bachmann is a graduate of the Winona State University. She received her J.D. at O.W. Coburn School of Law at Oral Roberts University and an LLM in tax law at the College of William & Mary. She's been married to her husband, Marcus, for more than 30 years, and together they have 5 children and 23 foster children. Today, Representative Bachmann will discuss how to revive America's competitive edge. Please join me in welcoming Representative Michelle Bachmann to California, to San Francisco, and in particular to the podium at the Commonwealth Club of California.
Thank you so much for that lovely introduction. It is a thrill for me to be in San Francisco. It's a thrill for me to be in front of all of you this afternoon to discuss what is one of the most exciting topics today. How can America regain her competitive edge? How can we once again know that we will be able to retain our status as the number one economic superpower in the world, a position that I think is good for America and one that I hope we can continue to retain. And before I go into my remarks, I'd first like to give some remarks on the news that we received today about the death of Muammar Gaddafi. For more than 40 years, we have lived with Muammar Gaddafi and the atrocities that he orchestrated, oftentimes against his own people. The world is a better place without Gaddafi. It is my hope that Gaddafi's reign of terror will be replaced with a government that respects its people in Libya and one that will be a good partner with the United States. Hopefully today will also bring an end to our military involvement in Libya, something that I have opposed from its beginning. And now for my remarks. Again, I thank you for your kind attention. In a letter to Thomas Jefferson, our second president, John Adams, wrote this, and I quote, "You and I ought not to die before we have explained ourselves to each other." You see, Adams and Jefferson had somewhat of a feud over the years, and Adams felt it was important that the two men understood each other before their final days. And the challenges that we face today in our nation have summoned a variety of opinions about the best course of action that our nation needs to take to solve them. And as a former federal tax litigation attorney, and also together with my husband, as a creator of our own small company that we are proud to say that we run as a profit, I can think of no better place than the San Francisco Commonwealth Club to offer my explanation into the crucible of public debate. So I'm very honored, as I stated, to be here with all of you today. This is a time-honored forum to speak with you about a subject that is little discussed but eminently important over the course of this 2012 presidential campaign. And over the last several months, all of us have been rightly concerned about the high unemployment that too many Americans are unfortunately experiencing in the midst of an economy that is continuing to stumble. But little noticed by most Americans was a startling piece of news that is partially responsible for the grave economic times that we are experiencing. It's the fact that America has slipped to the fifth place on the list of competitive nations. Yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid summed up quite nicely what I call the fantasy economic thinking that is dominating Washington, D.C. today, when Majority Leader Reid said, and I quote, "It's very clear that private sector jobs have been doing just fine. It's the public sector jobs where we've lost huge numbers, and that's about what this legislation is all about." And with all due respect, I say that statement could be entered into Ripley's Believe It or Not, because that's despite the fact that since 2007, private sector job losses have been three times greater than government's, and that federal employees take home, on average, $126,000 annually, which is 2.5 times the United States median. That statement does qualify, as I said, for Ripley's Believe It or Not. And the United States of America is history's most successful political and economic experiment. It's proved that a nation that's rooted in free market competition has led the world in innovation in areas that have advanced the disciplines of medicine, of science, of technology. And San Francisco has been the hub of much of that innovation. You've given much not only to this great nation, but to the world. And you've made America's quality of life second to none. That's good, and that's something we want to continue. But when government gets in the business of blindly choosing winners and losers, as in the case of Solyndra's of this administration, then it becomes our cash for government's clunkers. And worse, American competitiveness in the world becomes badly damaged. That's the casualty. For America to regain our competitive edge in the global economy, we have to fundamentally restructure how Washington, D.C. is spending our money. It's not their money. And we have to radically reform the tax code. We have to educate Americans better. We're not doing the job we need to do in education, and we need to train many of our workers far better than we have before. And we need to provide for more efficient movement of goods. We have to encourage fair trade relationships and reduce unilateral regulatory barriers for entry into the marketplace. The passing, unfortunately, of Steve Jobs saddens every one of us, I'm sure, in this room, because he was more than just the co-founder of this marvelous company known as Apple. He was an icon who represented the greatest of competitiveness. And he never settled constantly for asking employees if they had produced their best product. That's what we loved about Steve Jobs. We've always been about being on the cutting edge, leading the world in new ideas and the latest innovations, because Steve Jobs represented the ideal at its best. Who could have imagined just a few years ago that holding in our hand right now, or in your back pocket, or in your pocketbook, would be a small device that would fit just in the center point of your hand, that would contain all of your music collection, your camera, a video camera, your photo collection, your phone, and an encyclopedia, all connected in one small device? Who could have imagined? Steve Jobs imagined. And he and his team have changed our world for the better. And that Steve Jobs spirit still exists in the imaginations of young entrepreneurs trying to catch a break and trying to get ahead today. A recent Wall Street Journal article indicated that 77% of all students who were surveyed by Gallup about their aspirations responded in the affirmative. They want to be their own boss. That's a good thing. 45% of America's youth want to start their own business. And 42% said, I will invent something that changes the world. Let's hope so. And let's hope that happens. Because the next generation of Steve Jobs, I believe, is out there waiting to step up and drive the engine of American innovation and competition. As we know, entrepreneurship is the fastest growing course of study on college campuses nationwide. This should put all of our hearts to a flutter. So the desire to succeed remains in young people in America. But here's the challenge. Many of these young people lack basic information and basic experience in order to enter the workforce. You see, their level of experience doesn't equal their desire to succeed. So let's take by comparison a government enterprise, the United States Post Office, an agency that has served us all very well for many years. But the United States Post Office yearns to remain committed to paying higher labor costs that unfortunately bear no comparison to wages that are currently being paid in the private sector. The Wall Street Journal just reported that the United States Post Office is so desperate for self-preservation, they're now considering selling hunting license and country music CDs and coffee to try to meet their rising labor costs. They've failed to innovate and keep up with innovative ways of delivering and cutting down on their labor costs in order to deliver the mail to consumers, and so now they're billions of dollars in the red and looking once again to the taxpayer for money to bail them out. Unfortunately, the United States Post Office has failed us, the taxpayer, by failing in the test of innovation in reducing their labor costs. If these gimmicks fail to get them to break even, then perhaps they'll even have to resort to bake sales, as they say, tongue-in-cheek. The Post Office proves why government should not displace proprietary functions. That's what Steve Jobs practiced as one of the keys to his success. I quote from Steve Jobs, simplicity and saying no to 1,000 things. Instead, the oxymoron of government-run businesses is that they say yes to doing everything and will spend anything that's taxpayer money because they're not driven by the need to produce a profit at the end of their balance sheet. Researchers, entrepreneurs, investors across the United States have been paralyzed, unfortunately, by the current administration's anti-business policies that have created severe uncertainty in the business climate. As president, I want to assure you that I will signal by way of leadership to innovators that the time has come to once again unleash the genius of Adam Smith's invisible hand working to create the wealth of our nation. Because what drives investment and the execution of innovative ideas is an environment, a business environment that fosters it. A perfect example is the state of Israel, that enjoys 2.5 times the venture investments of the United States as a result of their culture embracing innovation. My Real Jobs Right Now solutions are aimed at fostering a similar culture, which will turn our economy around in the United States and create high-paying jobs that we need for 14 million unemployed Americans, and that comes with increased competitiveness and increased innovation. Our nation's ability to compete in the global economy begins with education. This is something I know about as a mother to 28 wonderful children. We must demand strong schools so that young Americans enter the workforce with the math, science, and problem-solving skills they need to succeed in what we know to be the knowledge economy. Education has always been the gateway to a better life in this country. It certainly was for myself. And our primary and secondary schools were long considered the world's best. When I was a child of a single mother, it was education that was my ticket out into finding a better life and joining this wonderful economy. But on an international math test recently, in 2003, United States high school students ranked, unfortunately, 24th out of 29 industrial nations surveyed. It seems year after year we receive those dismal results, and year after year, Americans' children suffer because politicians working together with American parents fail to deliver reform, true reform, in America's public school system. Our schools can do better. I got into politics because of education. And as a mother, I saw the politically correct dumbing down of our children's curriculum and decided that I needed to work to better reform the education system for our children. And that's why I would close the Federal Department of Education and return money and control to the... That's why I would return tax money and control to the states where they can best deploy education resources and decision-making power and authority over how those resources would be allocated. I would repeal No Child Left Behind. I would repeal the federal education law that is shackling local public school teachers in their ability to know the best way to educate children in the local school setting. Not only does the Department of Education not know what's best for local schools, they've taken billions of dollars from the states to pay for very expensive bureaucracy. That sort of government behavior must come to an end. Our competitiveness depends on well-educated people. American-educated scientists and engineers have historically been the driving force behind our tech revolution, but we're simply not graduating enough of them. To keep our competitive edge and to remain the world's top tech innovator, we have to raise the math and science skills of our students. This is a non-negotiable. It must be done. College tuition prices are out of control, while paradoxically, the availability of information has never been greater. Our nation's young entrepreneurs are graduating with enormous debt loads that often steer them away from pursuing a new business and instead towards stable jobs that increase their ability to pay down their loans. While we need to encourage young Americans to pursue their dreams and their innovative ideas, according to the newspaper USA Today, the amount of student loans that have been taken out last year crossed the $100 billion mark for the first time, and total loans that are outstanding today exceeds $1 trillion for the first time in history. Be prepared. We're hearing calls already for government to be prepared because government is encouraging a new higher education bubble that I unfortunately predict taxpayers will be pressured to pay for. Americans now owe more on their student loans than they owe on their credit cards. Every child deserves a quality education so that they can succeed in life while keeping America strong economically and militarily. We must never ignore the power of human capital in our quest to be the leading force for innovation and competition. And we must never forget that education begins in the home, and that it's the family that is the most important component of any child's education. We have to protect the integrity of the family and the life of every child. Part of producing an effective workforce means that we have to reform employment law. Employees deserve the right to work, and the federal government's National Labor Relations Board should not interfere with the right to work like they are currently doing with the Boeing company in South Carolina. Reforming employment law also means making it easier to reward good employees and to finding bad ones a new line of work. This also means reforming our unemployment insurance system. It was created 50 years ago to help workers through temporary layoffs. And under that model, after a business picked itself up, the employee could go back to the same job, at the same factory, at the same company, selling to the same customers. But that's not the world in which employees now live. Now, when workers are laid off, the job all too often is gone. Today, unemployment insurance, even by the admission of the administration's newest economic council member, Alan Krueger, is a disincentive to work, and it increases the length of time of joblessness. Another pillar for competitiveness is a healthy investment climate so that our technology industry will continue to thrive. This is an underreported story. High-tech capital investments are flowing out of the United States. They will flow back into the United States if we have internet delivery that's fast and efficient, if financial markets are strong, and if tax rates are kept low. To promote innovation, we should make the research and development tax credit permanent to maximize private sector innovation that encourages, especially here in the local San Francisco economy. That's why I have serious concerns about government getting involved in the regulation of the internet. That's why I have very serious concerns about the ambiguities of this legislation, which could lead to an explosion of destructive, innovation-killing lawsuits. In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan enacted tax reform that created a period of unparalleled prosperity, and I intend to increase our competitiveness by following his blueprint for tax reform, which had his core principle, which is my core principle, of stopping taxes on investment and productivity. If America is to once again regain our footing as the world's competitive leader, we must abolish the U.S. tax code and replace it with a fairer, flatter, more simple one that has at its core a corporate rate that is one of the lowest in the industrialized world. In addition to extending the capital gains exemption and modifying the code to promote investment, the corporate tax rate must be lowered substantially, and I will. As part of this revision, I would address the problem of foreign earnings that are trapped abroad, and I would enable American companies to bring those earnings home to the United States and invest those earnings here in America, a practice known as repatriation of American dollars. Repatriation and a low corporate tax rate would incentivize American companies to return to America's shores and spur manufacturing here. That would benefit our people and create millions of high-paying jobs. And most importantly, repatriation is a stimulus, a private stimulus in the United States economy, not funded on the backs of United States taxpayers. Uniquely American values include the right and the opportunity to work and the right to keep the fruits of our labors, that it is our money and not the government's to spend and to waste. Because, you see, without private property rights, there can be no true liberty. And without liberty, there can be no America. 14 million of out-of-work Americans, most of whom were laid off through no fault of their own, have lost their economic liberty. And America's job creators and small business owners like myself have lost our economic liberty under the weight of $1.8 trillion annually in compliance costs with government regulations. You heard me right. $1.8 trillion in annual compliance costs with business regulations. Now consider that together we send $2.2 trillion annually to the federal government in taxes this year. So by comparison, job creators spend nearly as much annually to comply with bureaucratic rules and mandates as together we send to the government in taxes. And I want to quote, "Entrepreneurs here are forced to test promising medical devices and costly animal studies for years before they can advance their products into clinical trials." Scott Gottlieb wrote that in the Wall Street Journal. I go on to quote Mr. Gottlieb. "This is no way to run a regulatory process if the FDA is serious about promoting medical innovation and advancing the public health." Unquote. Minnesota has been historically a great innovator in medical devices and medical technology, but the FDA overregulation is killing the medical device and drug innovation sectors in the United States. And this is just one example of how government regulation is stifling American innovation and competition. I will repeal massive government overregulation, beginning with the EPA, which is killing literally thousands of jobs in the United States. That's the first step in legalizing American energy production and creating 1.4 million high-paying jobs. I say that because we already have a working, functioning EPA that is more in touch with the needs and requirements in each state jurisdiction. The state EPAs can better handle those issues in each of our 50 states. And the EPA at the federal level, a newly reconstituted agency, could better deal with international issues and state-to-state case-by-case issues. This past week, I returned to Washington to vote for one of the components of my Real Jobs Right Now economic recovery plan. We finalized free trade agreements that the president, unfortunately, could have passed years ago, but chose not to. The benefits of American leadership to open global markets in the past half century have been enormous. A total of $1 trillion higher income every year, or nearly $3,500 for every man, woman, and child in America. The advocates of bigger government could try to spend twice that much money, and they wouldn't accomplish half of the good of trading globally with America's friends. I've always believed in the power of the American people. I've always believed in the importance of keeping marginal tax rates low. And I've observed firsthand the tax reform that economic geniuses in Washington can dream up don't begin to match the prosperity generated by pursuing private opportunities. The failure to seek new markets is a tax on the American dream. We can look around and we can see the fruits of bringing down barriers to trade. It has helped keep inflation under control. It has helped to keep interest rates low, and it's made goods more affordable to lower and middle-income consumers. In other words, our American standard of living has gone up, and that's a good thing for millions of Americans. My Real Jobs Right Now solutions call for repatriating over $1.1 trillion of American dollars from overseas back into the United States, where it can be put together, put to work in the most efficient and effective way by those who earned it. Massively cutting federal spending by eliminating government agencies altogether and the size of government, repealing Obamacare in its totality. I have that bill to do it. Which is the government takeover of our healthcare system. Cutting taxes on investment and productivity, including the corporate tax. Repealing the Job and Housing Destruction Act, better known as the Dodd-Frank bill, in its totality. And I have introduced that repeal bill as well when I sat on that committee. Repealing $1.8 trillion in annual job-killing regulations. Increasing exports by finalizing free trade agreements, which we did just this last week, spurring new investment in America, inspiring innovation, and legalizing American energy production, including decreased regulations on developing new energy supplies from our abundant domestic energy resources, and finally enforcing America's immigration laws. Ending taxpayer-subsidized benefits and magnets to those who break our laws and come into the United States illegally, as well as to their children. When the government borrows 43 cents of every dollar that it's spending, you know we're choosing an economic train wreck, which is why Admiral Mullen, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said, "Our national debt has profound national security implications." John Adams recognized that at critical times in America's history, a generation is required to set aside its preferred pursuits and instead embrace the sacrifices that are needed to secure the blessings of liberty to the next generation. We saw it happen with Adams' own generation, the founders, who put everything on the line and everything they owned to form a new kind of government, one unique in the annals of history. One founded on the consent of the people. One dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal, and women, and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. This is our nation's creed. Americans have always looked forward to new opportunities and embraced new challenges, and we can do so again to leave a better country for our posterity. We can restore the United States' competitiveness. That I know. But to do so, we must constrain the reach of government and protect the rights our founders gave their last full measure of devotion to ensure. May each one of us as true servants of the people and most assuredly of our blessed Constitution go and do likewise. And as we look to the future, as Bill Gates told us, during the last 30 years, U.S. innovation, and I quote Mr. Gates, has been the catalyst for the digital information revolution. If the United States is to remain a global economic leader, he went on to say, we must foster an environment that enables a new generation to dream up innovations. Talent in this country is not the problem. The issue is political will. I second Mr. Gates' statement. Answering great challenges is nothing new to America. It's what we have always done. We've always lived up to that challenge in every generation. Now the question is, will we live up to that challenge in this generation? We created the technology that landed man safely on the moon. That's not a cliche. That's reality. Not because it was easy. We did it because it was hard. We've sent space probes to explore the distant reaches of the universe. We've harnessed nuclear energy in our time. We've mapped the human genome. We've created the internet. We've pioneered integrated circuits that possess the computing power of Apollo spacecraft on a single silicone chip that you can barely see. And we can once again be the leader in global competitiveness. This can be ours because our time hasn't passed. Only the baton of responsibility has passed to the next generation of the next Steve Jobs and the next generation of leaders needed to create the competitive economic culture that we must have to flourish. I'm ready to meet those challenges as the next president of the United States and to do the hard work that's necessary to restore our nation to remain the economic leader that we are and that we must continue to be. Not only for America's children, your children, and my children, but for the next generation, and the generation after that, and the generation after that, and the generation of that. That's our focus, off into the future that the founders saw, the future that we too must be visionaries to imagine. God bless you, and God bless this wonderful nation.
Our thanks to Michelle Bachmann, U.S. Congresswoman from Minnesota and Republican candidate for president, for a fascinating talk. Thank you for being here. My name is Dan Ashley, member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and news anchor of ABC 7 Television in San Francisco, and very pleased to be your moderator for today's audience question period. And we should thank the Congresswoman because we have an embarrassment of riches. We have probably 200 people in the room, and I have probably 500 questions. So,
well, I'll cancel the rest of my events for today, and we'll take them all.
We'll get as many of them as we possibly can. So let's begin. I've tried to separate some of them, and we're going to move through them as quickly as we can and try to get as many of your questions in as well as some of mine as we move through this program. I've broken them down into a few core areas, and since you began talking about the death of Muammar Gaddafi. Let's begin with a couple of foreign policy questions from the audience today. You expressed great concern over the threat from Iran. Please address your opinion on what's happening in Pakistan.
I'm very concerned about the threat from Iran, and the Iranian threat in my mind is the premier threat that is dominating the Middle East today. It is the acquisition of a nuclear weapon. I say that because of the statements that have been made by the president of Iran as recently as 3 weeks prior to entering the United States to speak to the UN National Assembly. The statement was simply this. He sought the eradication of Israel from the earth. That is in parallel and in tandem to the statements he gave prior to that, saying that once Iran obtains a nuclear weapon, they would use that nuclear weapon to wipe Israel off the face of the earth and use a nuclear weapon also against the United States of America. Those are highly destructive statements and ones that I believe should be taken seriously. regarding Pakistan. Pakistan has been the staging ground for terrorist training activities. This we know to be true, and Pakistan has also been engaging in proxy wars as well in Afghanistan. We need to take the issue of the Iranian threat extremely seriously because of the benefit of time that Iran has had. They've been able to come closer to achieving their goal. And as was stated earlier, I'm privileged to sit on the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. We deal with the nation's classified secrets. We deal with the threats to the United States, both within the interior of our borders and those which come to us externally. And I will say, while this election is about jobs and the economy, we cannot forget the fact that there are very real national security concerns that we also need to be a part of this very important process in the 2012 selection process.
Thank you, Congresswoman. From the audience, an idea was expressed at the last Republican debate to get out of the United Nations. Your view on that?
I believe that the United Nations has been less than successful in many occasions. And I think that as President of the United States, I have a very high regard for the United States sovereignty, and I would be working to continue to secure United States sovereignty. One thing that George Washington said to the nation and to future generations in his farewell address is that the United States should be extremely careful to engage in unnecessary foreign entanglements. I am not an isolationist. I am not. But I also believe that a lesson that we should learn from the last dozen years is that once the United States becomes engaged in a foreign entanglement, it is extremely difficult to extricate ourselves from that engagement. The United States made the decision to be involved not only in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, under the Obama administration, the president has engaged us in Libya, and he has also engaged us at the request of Uganda in sending United States special forces as recently as last week. We are now engaged in four conflicts, and we are looking quite literally at the Department of Defense potentially losing $500 billion in resources because of the actions of the super committee. This is a calculus that simply won't work. We cannot be overextended. My opinion is NATO, and this is something that Secretary of Defense Gates stated, he called on NATO to stand on their own two feet. I believe also NATO needs to stand on their own two feet and provide for their own defense. I believe that the United States has to stop providing the defense forces for other nations across the world, and we need to get our act together when it comes to our military and our foreign defense. I stand with our military. I have tremendous admiration and respect for them. My father served honorably in the United States Air Force, my stepfather in the United States Army, and my brother retired full U.S. Navy. I have tremendous regard for our military, which is why they need to be fully resourced, but we cannot ask them to do a job that is impossible where we are so extended and they are not resourced. We have to be extremely careful about which conflicts we choose to enter into, because we must consider they can have extremely long tails and they can go on for decades, unfortunately.
On that subject, with respect to Iraq and Afghanistan, where we have been involved for a decade now, do you believe it was a mistake to get that involved in those conflicts? And what would you do as president to either escalate or de-escalate those conflicts?
This is an issue that will be discussed for years, and I think the most salient fact is the fact that last weekend we received word from the Iraqi government we were looking at drawing down to only 500 troops that would remain in Iraq after this year, and their presence would be primarily to be trainers for Iraqis. We were just told this weekend in a statement that was stunning, we were rebuffed in effect by the Iraqi government, despite the fact that we have spent literally hundreds of billions of dollars, but with the greater cost of being the loss of American life on behalf of liberating this nation and the people, we found out in a stunning rebuff that the Iraqi government said they would not grant immunity to those 5,000 who would remain behind. We cannot put American soldiers in a situation where they would not be granted immunity. Clearly, this is at the behest of Iran, who seeks to have influence in and dominance, but particularly influence in Iraq. This was a stunning series of slaps at the current administration, beginning last week, midweek, when we saw, in effect, an international assassination plot that was discovered by the United States with an Iranian assassination plot against Saudi Arabia, but to be carried out in the United States near or in our United States capital. This is a historic level of events that have occurred this last week and ones that we need to seek to understand as we move forward in the debate.
How would you as president respond to that Iranian threat specifically?
I would respond with absolutely everything that the United States can put on the line, because we cannot abide, we must not, and we cannot abide an Iran with a nuclear weapon. Because of the stated intentions of Iran, we would be subjecting the American people to the deployment of a nuclear weapon against our own people and also to the state of Israel. This is something that we need to consider. I believe when a madman speaks, you listen. And the statements of the president of Iran have been those of a genocidal maniac.
A question from the audience. As an American Jew, I would be interested to hear how a Bachmann administration would address the sovereignty of Jerusalem. And let me expand that just to speak generally about what you would do about Middle East peace. How would you approach that dilemma?
Are you asking me specifically, when you talked about the sovereignty of Jerusalem, do you mean...
Well, this is from the audience. Do you support the sovereignty of Jerusalem, I imagine is what this gentleman is asking. How would you approach negotiations with Palestinians and Israel?
I support the Jewish state of Israel. Israel has the right to exist and the right to defend herself. And And I also support moving the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which is Israel's stated capital. What we saw was an end run in September by the Palestinians to achieve statehood without the means of negotiation. The Palestinians know what they need to do. They need to recognize Israel's right to exist. They need to recognize that Israel has the right to defend herself. And they need to stop sending rockets on the Israeli people. This is the beginning of a platform before there can be statehood that is achieved. We also know from Hamas and the charter of Hamas and the Gaza region that there have been statements by the ambassador from the PLO in the United States that, according to the charter still continues to advocate the killing of the Jews. And also the statement is made that no Jews will be allowed to live in Palestine. These are areas that need to go through the negotiation process. They should not achieve an end run through the UN.
All right. Thank you, Congresswoman. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And our guest today is Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, Republican candidate for president. We've been focused on foreign affairs. I'd like to turn to some domestic issues.
Could I add one thing,
please,
if I could, just about Iran? My statements are about the president of Iran. My statements are not about the Iranian people. I want to make that very clear. Because we know in 2009 there was a yearning for freedom from the Iranian people. And I believe at that point it would have been prudent for the United States to do everything that we could to foster that desire for the Iranian people to be free of oppression. Unfortunately, that did not occur. Our enemy is not the Iranian people. Our enemy is an Iranian leadership that has a stated objective of using a nuclear weapon against the United States and using a nuclear weapon against our ally Israel.
All right. Thank you for that. To some domestic issues in the headlines, of course, from the audience. Would you please comment on the Occupy Wall Street movement? Your thoughts on that?
Well, I will. I think this is something that was very remarkable in an editorial that came out earlier this week by Doug Schoen, who is a Democrat strategist and also a Democrat pollster. He had done an interview of the Occupy Wall Street, and he had said that of those that were demonstrators, 98% believe in civil disobedience, and in excess of 30% believe in using violence to achieve those ends. I think that would be tremendously counterproductive for us to see that movement in the United States. What we need to do is get the economy moving. That's what we need to do. We need jobs. We need the economy to function again. And that's quite simply what we need to do.
You will often cite history and quote from our founding fathers and are a student of history. This country was founded on rebellion and civil disobedience in some respect. The Tea Party gets its name from the Boston Tea Party.
But the Tea Party picks up its trash after it has a demonstration. There's a difference.
We may be assuming
also,
facts and evidence.
Also, there is another difference. The Occupy Wall Street, much of the calls have been coming for more government spending and more government involvement in people's lives. One example I would give you is there was a call for the federal government to assume student loan debt and pay student loan debt. That's $1 trillion in debt. So the Occupy Wall Street is asking for more spending and more government as the answer to their problems. The Tea Party movement, in high contrast, is calling for less government and less spending so that individuals can solve their own problems. There is a 180-degree difference between the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street.
Do you understand why people are on the street protesting? What does it say about the state of the country at this moment?
Well, I think, again, you are looking at two different views of how to solve the current problem in the United States. And my Real Jobs Right Now plan, I don't want to wait until I'm president of the United States 14 months from now. I would happily give this plan to President Obama and say, please, use this plan, put it into effect today, because the current plans and the plans that the president's put into place during the course of his administration clearly have failed to turn the economy around. We need to try something different. We've seen a massive increase in spending, a massive unprecedented increase in the level of government involvement in private business. It has been a miserable failure. Now we have to have a government that embraces what works. That's free market solutions, because you see, it's really a framework of two philosophies. One says government-directed solutions focusing on temporary gimmicks based upon government-directed solutions. That hasn't worked, where government chooses winners and losers. I prefer permanent solutions driven from the private sector. We saw that in the 1980s. We saw success with that philosophy. That's what I am planning to engage as President of the United States.
All right, thank you. Number of questions from Herman Cain, about Herman Cain and his 999 tax plan. No, he did not send in a question. But if he did, I'm sure the candidate would be happy to answer it. Please tell us why you think the 999 tax plan would not work. And blending another question, do you believe his proposed 999 tax structure will hurt or help a family that makes less than $250,000 annually? What's wrong with his idea?
Number two, second, I would say, yes, I believe it would hurt that family. I'm a former federal tax litigation attorney. That's what I've dealt with, our taxes. Also, as someone who's created a business and runs it properly, we deal with taxes in our business. But also, as a member of Congress, I have seen up close and personal what the Congress is capable of when it comes to taxes. But I think, first of all, as an overview, what I would like to say is the plan that was proposed was a tax plan. It's not a jobs plan. And that's also a difference. Mine is an overall economic recovery plan that also contains a tax plan, but we need more than just changing the tax code in order to spur job creation. That'll be part of the answer, but not the entirety of the answer. Here's what the problem is with the 999 plan. On several levels, first of all, you are looking at giving Congress a brand new tax. Congress instituted, by way of example, the Spanish-American War Tax back in 1898. We still have the Spanish-American War Tax today. In 2006, we tried to repeal it. We couldn't even repeal it in 2006. We got part of it repealed, but we're still living with that tax. I'm just here to tell you, being on the front lines, you open up a new pipeline of taxation, Congress will very quickly widen it. Here's the other thing you need to know. When the income tax was instituted with the 16th Amendment in 1913, the top tax rate was 7%. By 1980, the top tax rate was 70%. tax rates don't stay where they're at. And if you have a new administration come in, which we had in 2008, where one party controls the White House and both sides of Congress, very quickly you will see the 999 go to 15-15-15 or 39-39-39 or 49-49-49, and it will not be 999. The other thing we need to consider is this is, in effect, a value-added tax, because this will hurt American production of American products. Because when we have foreign-produced products coming into the United States, there would be one 9% sales tax when they enter and when they're sold. Contrary to American-made products that are manufactured here, when one component of the product is made and then sold to a vendor, that's a 9% sales event. And then the next value is added to that product, and it's sold to the next vendor. That's a 9% sales event. So, in effect, you have a value-added tax, which means that American competitiveness is reduced. This will kill American jobs in the United States. We don't need that. And one thing that hasn't come out yet are the empowerment zones that are a part of this plan. Empowerment zones sound very good in theory. They lower the tax rate for some people, but not for others. So in other words, some people are more equal than others on the 999 plan. So what happens is that costs are shifted, taxes are borne by other Americans that aren't borne by some Americans. My plan is to flatten the tax for all Americans. I believe in a level playing field for all businesses, not picking winners and losers. I believe in a level playing field for all Americans, so we're all paying the same rate. And I believe also that every American should pay something, even if it's a dollar. We all benefit by this magnificent country. Everyone should pay something, because today only 53% of Americans pay federal income tax. 47% of Americans pay nothing. Everyone should pay something, even if it's a dollar.
From taxes to another issue that many in this room and in the country are concerned about, and that is health care. Question from the audience: would single-payer national health care improve the environment for true competitive capitalism in this country? And I'll blend another question: how would you help more Americans afford in health insurance?
Well, single-payer health care is another way of saying socialized medicine. Ultimately, that's what Obamacare will give us, is socialized medicine, because we will see, in all likelihood, the private insurance market collapse, and then government will take over health care. Consider, this is one-sixth of the American economy, and already the Obama administration has admitted that Obamacare is a failure. Last Friday, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius said the portion of Obamacare known as CLASS, C-L-A-S-S, that deals with long-term care, that's dealing with nursing home, she said it can't work. The numbers don't work. It's a bankrupt program. And she said, therefore, we, the Obama administration, will not put forward the CLASS Act. By the weekend, apparently, there must have been some bickering behind closed doors, because the Obama administration came out and repudiated the Health and Human Services Secretary and said, no, we're going to go full speed ahead. So in other words, we're going to go full speed ahead with a program that we know will bankrupt the country. The last thing we need right now are more programs that are going to bankrupt the country. That's why, coming from a competitiveness model, this is what I want to do. Repeal Obamacare and instead get rid of the monopoly that all 50 states have for private insurance companies. What we need to do is allow every American the ability to be able to buy any health insurance policy they want anywhere in the United States of America, with no government-imposed minimum mandates. Buy anything you want and pay for it, your premiums, your copays, your deductibles, your pharmaceuticals, your medical devices, everything. Pay for it with your own tax-free money. And then have true medical malpractice reform, because you see, the problem in health care is cost. That deals with the cost aspect, and everyone benefits.
Thank you. Congresswoman, you spoke about what you call massive government overregulation, including the Environmental Protection Agency. This is from the audience. How do we balance economic growth with environmental stewardship in this country?
Well, we have to make sure that we continue to maintain clean air and clean water and do everything that we can to continue to focus in that. But we also see that the EPA has been the center point for killing jobs in this country in the last few years, because we've seen the increase in bureaucracy and the regulatory burden. Even the Obama administration had to admit that in the last month or two. They had regulations that would have, in effect, closed down 20% of all the electricity-generating plants in the United States that are coal-fired plants. Even the Obama administration realized that we couldn't make it in this country without those plants. So they had to pull back on the regulatory burden. So what we need to do is introduce common sense. The United States has come up with the innovations that have helped preserve the environment. There is no one in this room that wants dirty air. There's no one in this room that wants dirty water. We all want the same thing. But it's through innovation, it's through competitiveness that we find new ways to keep the environment clean. That's what I want. I want to unleash the power of technology so we can solve and deal with our environmental problems rather than having the federal government mandate what must be done and instead kill job creation in this country.
Thank you. A couple more domestic policy questions, and I'll move to another area as we wind the clock down here. This is from a member of the audience today. As our next president, would you support increasing U.S. immigration rates, reducing U.S. immigration rates? More broadly, what would be your immigration policy in the United States?
I would enforce immigration policy. We have very good laws that are on the books for immigration. The problem is the United States is not currently enforcing those laws. Also, there's a tremendous cost to illegal immigration in the country. It costs the American taxpayer $113 billion a year. Here in California, you bear that more than most states. The state and local governments bear the cost of $82 billion in taxpayer-subsidized benefits for illegal aliens. That works out to approximately $1,000 per household. That's a very real cost, and that's hurting American competitiveness. When I say that, that is not to say that the United States is anti-Hispanic, or that I see a racism in the United States. I go to countries or to states all across the United States. When I talk to people about this issue, I do not sense racism. I don't see bigotry when people talk about this. What they're concerned about is losing economic competitiveness, and they're worried about the tax burden that this is putting on the state and local governments. It's an issue. It's also a national security issue. There are 59,000 other than Mexicans that crossed America's borders last year. This includes people that are coming into the United States illegally from nations that are state sponsors of terror. We have to consider the national security component. And also, we have a very real narco-terrorism war on our southern border that has to be dealt with. I was last weekend in Arizona meeting from federal to local law enforcement. And people, in effect, have been robbed of their private property ownership and their liberties along the southern border in Arizona. This is real. Because what I was told by officials in Arizona is their state border has actually moved 70 miles north. And it's a no man's land for people that own the property on that border. No one can know what that's like except for those people. So the federal government has failed. Utterly. Both parties have failed the American people on this issue, both Republican and Democrat. As President of the United States, I will enforce the laws that are on the books, and we simply have to do away with taxpayer-subsidized benefits for people who are breaking America's laws.
Quickly, if you can, we had a report came out yesterday that we reported on the state of Bay Area roads and bridges, and a surprising number of them in disrepair. That is probably reflected around the country. From the audience, what would you do to deal with the nation's infrastructure problem that needs trillions of dollars over the next several years, and how would you fund that? How much of a priority would that be for you?
Well, isn't it amazing that this was the discussion when President Obama came into office and said that he wanted to use the nearly $1 trillion, and it was over $1 trillion with the debt service on the stimulus, that was going to be used to build and repair America's crumbling infrastructure of roads and bridges. The premise of the question is accurate. We do have a real problem with roads and with bridges. I come from a state that endured a horrific tragedy when we had the I-35W bridge that went down. In my own district, I have one of the longest unfinished bridge projects in the history of the United States. We're trying to get that bridge ultimately replaced and repaired. We have a very real issue in this country. We have to have roads. We have to have bridges. We have to modernize our structure. The question is, what is the best way to do that? There's been one discussion that potentially we move again that ability back to the local, to the state governments, keep the money in the states without sending it to the Federal Department of Transportation. This is just one tiny example of why I am looking at that possibility of sending the building and maintenance of our roads and bridges back to the states rather than having the federal government care for it. At the very beginning of the recession, which wasn't that long ago, there was one federal employee in the Federal Department of Transportation that made in excess of $170,000 a year. 18 months into the recession, because of the stimulus and the federal government money that was spent, there were 1,690 federal employees that were making over $170,000 a year. If you want to know what the stimulus went to stimulate, it went to stimulate government. Government won in that stimulus, but we don't have a lot of roads and bridges to show for it. That's why I would be inclined to embrace the idea that we need to leave the money in the states so that the states can deal with this issue. We've solved this issue with this unfinished bridge project. We have the governors on both sides of the states, and it's a Democrat and a Republican governor that agree. We have Democrat and Republicans agreeing at the Senate and the congressional level. We need to build this bridge. The problem is a bureaucrat in Washington, D.C., who decided that our unfinished bridge is visual pollution. This is what we're dealing with the bureaucracy in Washington. A federal bureaucrat can have so much power that they can stop a bridge project and, in effect, jack up the cost of a bridge to the taxpayers because, in their eyes, they think it's visual pollution when there's already a bridge there. This is what we're dealing with, and that's why I think that it makes a lot of sense to let the states, who know what they need, keep that money and get their roads and bridges back in order.
Move to a few items about the campaign now from the audience. It's been a rigorous campaign, a lot of debating by all of the Republican candidates for president. This is, I know in my industry, in the news business, we hear from a lot of people who get tired of the arguing in politics and the bickering in politics. This is a question from the audience. I'm a lifelong conservative, tired of both parties' politics, as the usual bickering, and especially concerned with all of the Republican bickering during the debates. How is this hurting the party and the country?
Well, I think that people are rightly concerned that we're not focused on solutions. That's what we need to talk about, are the solutions. How are we going to turn the country around? That's why at my website, michellebachman.com, I posted real jobs right now, and I've given that plan to the President of the United States and said, take it, use it, plagiarize it, make it yours, because it's not about me. It shouldn't be about a party. It shouldn't be about any of us. It should be about you, because you're the country. That's what government is. It's all of you. It's not the buildings. It's not the bureaucracy in Washington, D.C. At least it shouldn't be. It should be about you and your lives, a higher quality of life and competitiveness. That's what we're dedicated to talking about today. How can the United States remain the most vital economic super powerhouse of the world? That's my goal, to make sure that we remain that way. So it shouldn't be partisan. And that's what I'm actually seeing in this election. When I talk to people around the country, people are fed up. They've had it. They're fed up. They're fed up. There's disaffected Democrats, disaffected Republicans, disaffected independents. For the first time, I think, in years, people who've never been political a day in their life are tuning in because they sense that America is in a severe state of decline. And for the first time in history, I get this from mothers all across America. I'm a mom. I get this from mothers, that they see and they feel in their heart that their children aren't going to have what they had. This is very real, because for mothers, one thing really impacts them. It's this foreclosure issue, losing their nest, the home where they make the family, and when they pour into the kids that they birthed and they're trying to raise up, because nothing is more important, not just to mothers, fathers too, than those kids and making sure they succeed. That's it. That's the nub of this election and what it's about. People are nervous about that next generation, and that's what we have to focus on. What's the solution? How will we make their lives better and get all of the nonsense out of the way?
We have one time for one or two last little questions. I saved a few curiosity items that were interesting from the audience. Do your foster children live in your home? Someone would like to know.
Well, they certainly did when they were with us. We had 23 foster children over the home. It was one of the greatest experiences of our lives. We absolutely loved these kids, and we were crazy about them. They don't now, because they're now older, they're grown, they're gone, they're launched, and that was our job, to make sure that they were graduated from high school, and we were able to hopefully successfully launch them off into the world. And also part of our goal was to see them successfully reunited with their biological mother and father or extended family if they possibly could be. Every child wants to know they're loved. And my husband, who's a wonderful dad, told me, he said, you know, every child just needs to know that there's one person in their life who's crazy about them. That's what we tried to be. We tried to be that person who is in their corner, who championed for them and who advocated for them. They were a wonderful addition to our life. They were older than our biological children, and now our biological children are all launched too. Our oldest son is a physician, and our youngest daughter, biological daughter, just went off to college this year. We're extremely proud of these 28 kids. So just so you know, you're looking at the old woman in the shoe right here. That's me.
On that note, we will end our discussion. Our thanks to Michelle Bachman.
Thank you to all of you. Thank you so much for your kind attendance and attention. Thank you.
Our thanks to Michelle Bachman, U.S. Congresswoman from Minnesota and Republican candidate for president. We also want to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Dan Ashley, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.